This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, in Ohio, they're going to pave over the bottom of a river with a new kind of gunk to keep the PCBs from moving downstream. 96 species of fish in American ocean waters are classified as overfished, but plans are underway to restore them. We hear from our listeners, and we chat with CNN's Barbara Pyle. She's the first journalist ever to win the United Nations Sasakawa Environment Prize. And in the Earth calendar, bugs are preparing to hibernate, even in Florida. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. Officials in Toledo, Ohio, have approved a plan to use experimental pellets to cover the bottom of the Ottawa River, a waterway heavily laden with PCBs. The experimental pellets, or AquaBlock, as the product is called, have only been used once before. But as the Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports, company officials are hoping AquaBlock will provide a natural remedy to a very unnatural problem.
The Ottawa River, located in the northwestern tip of Ohio, is believed to be one of the largest sources of PCB pollution in Lake Erie. Officials at Ohio's Environmental Protection Agency say much of the contamination is a result of landfills located in the Ottawa's floodplain. The river is considered to be among Ohio's top five polluted waterways, according to Chris Yoder, manager of the Ecological Assessment Unit with the state EPA.
Levels, I think, in the sediment or in the parts per million range, which is very high. I think it's in some cases in the hundreds of parts per million, and in fish tissue, we've tested fish there that have had contaminant levels as high as 25 to 30 parts per million, and that's well in excess of any safe eating guidelines that we have.
Yoder emphasizes the Ottawa River is an urban stream with a long history of industrial impacts as well as sewer overflows. In the meantime, Ohio's Department of Development is hoping to clean up the river enough so that a new Jeep automotive plant can be constructed. The river is too contaminated to be dredged, so officials have decided to try an experimental product called AquaBlock. John Hull is president of Hull & Associates, an environmental engineering firm based in Toledo. He says AquaBlock is the brainchild of his partner Tom Nachman, who was contacted by federal officials to help solve an environmental problem in Alaska. Hull says a waterway at Fort Richardson had such high phosphorus levels in 1993 that ducks were dying in large numbers.
In his typical fashion, he thinks outside the box a little bit. He thought, well, maybe the problem isn't that you need to keep the ducks away from the area. Maybe you need to keep the contaminated sediments away from the ducks. So he turned around the whole idea and came to me and said, we need a barrier layer that we can place easily, something from the air initially because of the difficulty of using conventional technology in that area. And we worked together and came up with AquaBlock.
Hull says survival rates among the ducks has increased since AquaBlock was applied at Fort Richardson. New Waste Concepts, the production company of Hull & Associates, is also pointing to AquaBlock's all-natural features as one of its benefits. Tim Johnson is the company's general sales manager.
Well, bentonite is a product that is a natural clay that expands very readily in water. And what we did is we attached that around rock so that we created a ball or a sphere that would drop into water and not immediately disperse. And when dropping a volume of these into water, they lay on the bottom next to each other, and as they start to expand, they start to basically kind of push against themselves. And as they do that, they form a sealed surface.
Johnson says the company uses concrete mixing equipment to process the product. About 3 acres of riverbed, some of the Ottawa's most contaminated areas, will be covered with about 5 inches of AquaBlock that will expand to create a layer approximately 12 inches thick. Another unique feature of AquaBlock is that, unlike other sheet or panel-type products that cover toxic materials, few, if any, can be applied from above the water. In Alaska, they dropped AquaBlock from Black Hawk helicopters to protect themselves from rounds of ammunition located in the pond. In the Ottawa River, stirring up the PCBs when AquaBlock is dumped from a barge or by some other method is just one of the obstacles the company faces. Again, John Hall.
That's why we're doing column testing and bench scale testing to determine what size a particle needs to be manufactured for different water columns and different sediment thicknesses, different sediment characteristics. We would not recommend anyone go out willy-nilly and throw the stuff in the water. You have to determine what your sediment column and makeup is like. What is the contaminant of concern? What are the flow characteristics? When is the best time of year to place this material?
Hall says AquaBlock will also be tested in an area with less contaminated sediments to monitor the product's long-term effectiveness. He admits that AquaBlock isn't the solution to every problem, but says it might help better a bad situation until other solutions are found. The EPA's Chris Yoder agrees.
Natural stream substrates function best when they're very penetrable and not sort of a cementing. There's a lot of poor water space that a lot of function takes place with bacteria and other organisms that really form the base of the food chain. And in a normal situation, this probably would not be a good thing to do. But in this particular case, given the severity of the problem and the urgency of the problem, this probably is, on balance, a good approach.
New Waste Concepts is expected to begin applying AquaBlock in the Ottawa River in late winter or early spring. I'm Stephen Westcott for The Environment Show.
Last October, on the first anniversary of the reauthorization of the Magnuson Act, which governs the way we manage fisheries in the United States waters, the National Marine Fisheries Service released a report indicating about 20% of the species they examined are overfished, which means they could become commercially extinct.
We identified some 86 species that are currently overfished and 10 more that are anticipated to be approaching overfishing within the next 2 years. So there's some 96 out of a total of about over 500 species that we looked at that are currently overfished.
That was Gary Matlock, Director of the Office of Sustainable Fisheries of the National Marine Fisheries Service. His office is in charge of seeing that the 8 regional fisheries councils around the country draw up and implement plans to ensure that recovery of those stocks occurs within the next 10 years. The plans themselves are to be completed by the second anniversary of the reauthorization, or October 1998. The revised Magnuson Act has a number of new requirements which are designed to put an end to the consequences of overfishing. Kim Davis, Regional Fisheries Project Manager for the Center of Marine Conservation, which is a nonprofit environmental group, describes the changes.
There are 3 big improvements to the Act. They deal with overfishing, bycatch, and habitat protection. Whereas the Act previously said that we shouldn't be overfishing, it actually required some wiggle room there and allowed it to happen. It allowed fishing levels to be set based not only on biology, but also on social and economic concerns. The Act now says we'll end overfishing. It also says that we're going to rebuild depleted stocks, and it says we're going to start doing it in the next 2 years. It says we need to finish rebuilding by the end of the next 10 years where possible. Second big change was with respect to bycatch. And as you may know, there's a lot of waste in our fisheries. There is a lot that is harvested, or rather caught and killed, but not harvested and sold. For instance, in the shrimp fishery, there's a tremendous amount of bycatch. In the Gulf, more than 80% of what's caught and killed in shrimp nets isn't shrimp. The Act now says that bycatch will be minimized. Previously, it was silent, so this is a great change. It's going to be really meaningful to a lot of our fisheries. And the third one is also very exciting. Whereas the Act was previously pretty silent on the topic of habitat, it now says that we're going to describe and identify the habitat which is essential to fish.
Between now and next October, the regional councils have to revise plans for each species to ensure their recovery. This involves publishing a draft plan, holding public hearings, and then securing approval from the council, which includes people of widely differing perspectives. Patricia Fiorelli, Public Affairs Officer for the New England Fishery Management Council, located in Saugus, Massachusetts, lists some of the strategies being considered by her council to bring back fish populations. She says in the New England area, there are 13 overfished species, which include groundfish, scallops, and lobster.
We will, I'm sure, use the same kinds of management measures we have before. Area closures, restrictions on the amount of time people can spend fishing for those species. We have what you call trip limits, how many pounds of fish you can bring in at a time, perhaps some kind of quota. There are a number of different tools, and it's kind of hard to project because we try to tailor those measures to each fishery.
While the New England Council has been criticized in the past for moving too slowly to take stringent measures opposed by some of its fishermen members, significant areas off Georgia's Bank were declared off-limits for fishing starting in 1994. Fiorelli says recovery is beginning for Gulf of Maine cod, yellow-tailed flounder, and haddock. An unintended but welcome result of closing the area to fishing has been the recovery of scallops as well. Sonia Fordham, Fisheries Project Manager for the Center of Marine Conservation, says there have been other successes in New England waters. To save fisheries, it's important to reduce bycatch, which are the fish and animals thrown away or killed because they're hooked or netted while the fisher is attempting to catch something else.
In New England in particular, they have a bycatch success story. In the northern shrimp fishery, which fishes for this small type of shrimp in the Gulf of Maine, a number of years ago they put in what's called a finfish excluder device. It's called the Nordmoor Grate, and it excludes larger finfish, flounders, and so forth that are often caught in the trawls. So we look towards technology to look at fish behavior and ways to exclude the fish that are, or other marine life that are unwanted. We're also in New England working on these devices called pingers that are put on gill nets that are intended to avoid marine mammals or deter marine mammals, so that they don't get caught in the catch.
Shrimp bycatch is a significant problem in the Gulf of Mexico because it threatens another important fish stock. Kim Davis, who follows the Gulf Council for the Center for Marine Conservation, says the problem is not going to be easy to solve.
In the Gulf, the real action is going to be with respect to the red snapper fishery. The red snapper fishery is a real important fishery of the Gulf region, economically, socially. There are a lot of people involved. And biologically, it's a fish that should be very, very plentiful in the Gulf. However, it's been overfished pretty severely. And not just from the directed fishery, but also, in sort of an interesting twist of events, by the shrimp fishery. Because, as I said, a lot is caught in shrimp nets that isn't shrimp. And a lot of juvenile red snapper are caught in shrimp nets. So actually restoring the red snapper fishery is going to require some changes in the shrimp fishery, as well as the red snapper fishery. And the truth of the matter is that the shrimp fishery is very powerful politically. So that's going to be a struggle.
So a year after Magnuson reauthorization, there are some positive signs. Strategies are being put in place to reduce fishing pressure off American coastlines. And the next milestone comes up a year from now, when the new management plans covering all U.S. waters are supposed to be in force. I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show has been receiving email and calls from all over the place. Rachel Phillips has more.
Thanks, Peter. A Talking Green discussion on the auto industry and its role in reducing carbon emissions caught the attention of one listener. He sent us a lengthy email on how the auto industry has avoided using the best technology to reduce emissions over the years. Ralph Kenyon of Massachusetts wrote, "The auto industry representative on your show exhibited the typical resistance that I saw from them and from government during my letter writing days in the late 80s and early 90s. Even Saturn, a supposedly technologically advanced car, still uses the worst possible propulsion system, gasoline internal combustion reciprocating." Larry Holman contacted us by the internet to say, "I heard your radio program today on WSNY from Columbus, Ohio. It sounds as if freedom is the cause of all the environmental problems. If we take them away, the environment would be better off. I don't agree. Thanks for all your comments. We want to hear what you think. You can reach our comment line anytime by calling 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Or you can drop us an email at green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. For the Environment Show, I'm Rachel Phillips.
This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Elton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CARHERE. To save our ocean fish stocks, a lot more controls are going to be put on how, where, and how many fish are being caught. Should the government do more to help the fishers who used to rely on the catch to make a living? If so, what? Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. Barbara Pyle, Vice President of Environmental Policy and CNN's Environmental Editor, has been awarded the 1997 United Nations Sasakawa Environment Prize. It's the first time a journalist has ever won the prestigious award. I recently spoke to Pyle about the prize. Barbara, you are the first environmental journalist ever to win the Sasakawa Prize. How's it feel?
Well, actually, Peter, it's the first journalist, period, to win this prize. This prize is usually reserved for very prestigious and brilliant academics and scientists, you know, such as Lester Brown and Paul and Ann Ehrlich. And I don't know how it feels. Quite honestly, I'm in shock, and so I don't really feel yet. When I got the news, it was sort of this can't be happening, and I guess I really won't believe it happens. It's happening until it happens.
Barbara, you've been involved in trying to educate the public about the environment for many years now.
A long time, Peter.
How do you think we're doing?
We go sort of up and down. I actually believe that the public is more informed than than programmers give them credit for. I'm very impressed with some of the recent surveys that I've seen about the public interest in the climate change issue. And I believe that we're doing a lot better than I ever dreamed we would do. When I embarked on this mission 17 years ago to try to create an informed constituency on environmental issues, I never dreamed that we would get as far as we've gotten. I never dreamed by even the beginning of the 90s people would be recycling or even caring.
Increasingly, we hear, particularly in the print side of things, that editors are saying to folk that used to cover the environment full-time, well, maybe we'll split you between the environment and sports or whatever, that the number of people dedicated to environmental reporting is not growing, is it?
I just attended the Society of Environmental Journalists annual meeting, and in fact, there is a tremendous amount of pressure on the journalists to do fewer stories, and I think it's unfortunate, because I really do believe that the public now more than ever want more stories about the future of the planet. I think the public is starting to understand the concept of intergenerational equity, and that what we do now will impact future generations. and that these issues are real issues, that the environment is not a something that it's just a bunch of left-wing lunatics, that we have to live in it. It's part of us. We're part of it.
That was Barbara Pyle, CNN's environmental editor. She's the latest winner of the Sasakawa Environment Prize. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. It's late fall, and bugs of all kinds are preparing to hibernate for another winter season. Even in Gainesville, Florida, where you wouldn't expect such hibernation to occur, insects enter a diapause phase which halts their development. Mark Hostetler, professor of zoology at the University of Florida, says insects diapause in a pupa or larval form. With moth larvae, often finding their winter homes in tree bark and waiting for warmer, longer days.
You know, even through the winter of Florida, you have periodic warmings where you get insects flushed out, and you'll have butterflies almost all winter long coming out, hatching and flying about and laying their eggs. Bees typically will go into a sort of a hibernation where they gather all the honey during the summer, store it in all the combs, and you just hunker down there for during the winter and come out during the spring to, when the flowers come out. So insects are doing lots of things right now. People always think, well, what do mosquitoes do during the winter? I mean, when it really freezes, a lot of the eggs that the mosquitoes lay can tolerate these freezes, and as soon as it warms up and water comes back, they hatch out and you get mosquitoes all again. So there, lots of things are happening right now, but you don't see as many insects flying about now as you do during the summer or spring.
Hostetler says different insects hibernate for different periods of time, with some hunkering down for a fixed period and others responding to warmer temperatures.
You know, moths, a wasp, a lot of them are in a pupa stage now where they've metamorphosed and they've just gone through a diapause where they don't develop until it gets warmer. So moths, wasps, some of the butterflies do this too, although periodically if you have a warming period, they will come out, hatch out early before spring comes out. And one species, the love bug, people think, you know, they come out in May and September in Florida, and people are like, where the heck do these love bugs come from? And why, you know, do they come out in May and September? And what's going on is that the love bugs lay their eggs in rotting, decaying organic matter. And when they lay the eggs in May, it's hot enough that they develop really fast into the larval stage onto the adult stage, and so they come out in September. But then September all the way to the next May is a cool period, and so they don't develop as fast. So they're in the soil still eating and munching and doing the things that the larvae of love bugs do, but they do it at a much slower rate, so they don't actually metamorphose into adult until May comes around.
After hibernating, Hostetler says love bugs spend 5 or 6 months underground, eating decaying matter. They come out to mate for 3 days to a week, and then they die. This compares with bees, which can live for a number of years. For this bug lover, it's one of the most fascinating parts of the animal world.
It's neat to think that, you know, they reduce their development rate where they just use very minimal amounts of energy. They just essentially, you know, kind of think of bears that just go into where their heartbeat slows down to, you know, almost very slow pulse. Their use of fat and sugars and stuff is very, very reduced. And it's just neat to think that an insect can just all of a sudden cut all that out and then get reactivated when warmth comes back into an environment. And, you know, we as humans can't really do that, but insects have a neat way of doing that.
Professor Hostetler says insects, like most other animals, use whatever means necessary to pass along their genes from one generation to the next. It's natural selection at work. So it's no wonder that love bugs mate in such a short period of time. If you spent half the year underground eating decaying matter, your love life would be short too. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Thank you.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, we visit a laboratory ship frozen far up in the Arctic Ocean where scientists are studying the ice. Salmon farming. Young fish are raised in a hatchery and then kept in pens in the sea. Two experts lock horns about whether this is a good idea. European farmers swap their pitchforks for the internet. And musician Paul Winter takes us to a special canyon where he plays his soprano saxophone. More than 50 scientists from five countries have converged on a remote part of the Arctic Ocean to conduct studies of large ice packs. The temperatures are cold, and the harsh environment makes it difficult to do anything, let alone conduct scientific studies. But the rewards could be great. As part of the Environment Show's continuing series on global warming, Stephen Westcott reports on how the research could help scientists better understand the effect climate change will have on the Arctic.
The surface heat budget of the Arctic Ocean Project, also known as SHEBA, is the largest science experiment ever supported by the National Science Foundation in the Arctic Ocean. The project, supported by the NSF and the Office of Naval Research, includes a fleet of icebreakers, research aircraft and balloons, a naval nuclear submarine, and satellites. The research vessel is an icebreaker that has been frozen in the Arctic pack ice and left to drift for a year, a sort of floating science station located 300 miles north of the Alaska shoreline, which means little if any daylight and very, very cold temperatures. Richard Moritz, a researcher with the Applied Physics Laboratory at the University of Washington, is at the station, and he says temperatures have already reached minus 32 degrees Celsius.
We expect during the winter to see temperatures at least down to minus 45, if not lower. The area around the ship where we're studying and deploying our instruments is pack ice, and it's covered with snow now. There's about 16 centimeters of snow on the ground, and it's undulating with a lot of interesting variations in thickness and the surface shapes on the ice. The ice ridges and breaks and melts during the summer, and all of this makes a wonderful landscape. And we walk around on it as if it were solid ground and do our work, even though we're sitting on top of a 2-meter-thick ice sheet over a 3,000-meter-deep ocean.
Moritz adds that as winter progresses, colder temperatures and darker days will make the working environment difficult, to say the least. But the sacrifices are well worth it. The research being conducted there will give scientists a better idea of how global warming is impacting the Arctic environment. Richard Moritz says the project began about 2.5 years ago and has three phases.
In phase one, we were studying the existing data sets concerned with the heat budget of the Arctic. We were looking at climate models, trying to determine what the most important things were that needed improvement in those models. And we were also developing technology that could be brought to bear in phase two. We're now in phase two, and that's the field experiment phase.
The third phase will begin in about a year and involve the intensive use of the data sets they collect and climate modeling studies, according to Moritz. He says researchers are trying to understand the Earth's climate as a whole, taking into consideration the atmosphere, the ocean, ice cover, snow, plants, and chemicals.
One way in which we do that, the most comprehensive tool we use is the Global Climate Model, sometimes referred to as a GCM. And this is a model that has much of the physics of the climate system cast as a bunch of differential equations, which are solved by a computer. It's a little bit like a weather forecasting model, but it's dealing with processes on a much longer time scale. So my particular specialty is the study of the processes that go into these models, and in particular the ones that are associated with the Arctic Ocean and pack ice and Arctic processes in general.
Moritz says scientists will be mapping ice patterns and measuring such things as ice thickness, heat conduction, ice salinity, and other factors, which will enable researchers to make better predictions. He says current models are unreliable because of a lack of information, and they can't take into account unpredictable events that can affect climate, such as volcanic eruptions.
But I think as far as the effect of the greenhouse gases, I tend to think they're pretty much on the mark that there will be warming. On the other hand, when you look at the Arctic, there's a real wide variation in the predictions of these models, which is one of the reasons we're here. Some of the models predict that the pack ice here will ultimately disappear completely within a time span of maybe 50 or 100 years. Other models have a relatively much more modest effect. If it were to disappear, it would be a huge impact on the Arctic Ocean ecosystem.
Moritz says the payoff of the SHIBA project will be that researchers will have more confidence in the predictions of how global warming is affecting the Arctic environment. I'm Stephen Westcott for The Environment Show.
Almost a third of the salmon on the worldwide market is now grown in farms, and salmon farming is a growing industry. While salmon farming produces a prized food, it raises substantial environmental questions because of the waste produced, its impact on native fish, and its use of resources. I have two experts with me. One is Michael Weber. He's the former special assistant to the director of the National Marine Fisheries Service, who joins us from California, and Joe McGonigal. He's the executive director of the Maine Aquaculture Association, and it turns out that in Maine, salmon has become the second most valuable fishery after lobster. So they lock horns over the question, is salmon farming a good idea? Joe McGonigal, what do you think?
Oh, I think it's a terrific idea. In Maine, for example, it has made a major difference in one of the poorest counties east of the Appalachians, Washington County, where for the first time in generations, people have full-time, year-round, high-paying jobs. The jobs average about $35,000 a year, which is above average in Maine. They pay full benefits, retirement, health care, et cetera. So it's been a tremendous boon economically to the regions where salmon is farmed.
And Mike Weber, what do you think?
Well, salmon farming is, whether or not it's a good idea, it has been growing very, very rapidly, and it's been growing largely without very careful scrutiny, both for environmental and economic impacts. And I think we all know that we need to grow more food in the future. My question is whether or not this is the way to do it, and we'll get into the impacts later on. And that's really the main concern, I think, that we have is with the rapid growth and the lack of scrutiny.
Well, let's go directly then to our next question, and that is salmon farming acceptable with respect to the risks and hazards that it produces? And, Mike, let's start with you.
Well, let me just identify some of those risks, and they are perhaps less so in Maine than in other areas. Maine is a relatively small producer, but in places like Chile, Puget Sound, British Columbia, Norway in particular, there are major problems that have developed. In Norway, every year, roughly one in a third million salmon escape from pens. And they take with them diseases which have caused problems to wild runs of salmon. And they've also basically out-competed wild salmon runs in two dozen rivers. There are problems with waste that are generated by salmon farms. Although these are relatively efficient converters of feed into protein, they still produce quite a bit of waste. Anywhere from 270 to 1,000 tons of waste are produced for each 1,000 tons of salmon. And they also have impacts on marine wildlife. In British Columbia, 500 seals and sea lions are shot every year because they are attracted by salmon pens.
Okay, Joe McGonigal in reply.
Well, boy, that's an awful lot of information to respond to in 20 seconds, but let me just focus on the disease issue.
Take more time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. The the idea that wild or caged salmon spread diseases to the wild population is really something that is more speculative than real. There has never been anywhere in the world a documented case of a farmed salmon transferring disease to wild. It's an area of concern because you're growing highly concentrated numbers in a small area, and so that if a disease breaks out, then you certainly have the risk of an epidemic occurring and a lot of pathogens being shed into the water. But truthfully, the fish that we're putting in the water are actually cleaner than the fish that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service puts in the water all over the West Coast, and here on the East Coast as well for Atlantic salmon. These fish are vaccinated. They are kept in certified disease-free hatcheries. We pair mate the brood stock. We lethally sample the brood stock. We do 100% lethal sampling to test for diseases. There is no disease in these fish when they go in the water, and they're typically vaccinated against the most significant endemic diseases in their local areas. So I think that's really a red herring. I think the issue of waste is also, I think maybe Mike may be dealing with some outdated information from Norway. There were certainly problems in the early days of the industry in the late 70s, early 80s, when it was not entirely clear what the pattern of feeding ought to be. Today, for example, in Maine, we have we do baseline environmental surveys of the bottom and the water column before sea cages are sighted, and we do biannual surveys every year thereafter. And year after year after year now, since 1990, the state of Maine has dived and filmed under the sea cages, and they find, in fact, that there's no significant bioaccumulation under the pens.
Okay. Mike, in response.
In response, I would just say that there is a very clear correlation between the spread of salmon farming and the spread of certain kinds of diseases in areas like Scotland and Norway. And while there is no smoking gun, the correlation is very, very strong. The second thing is that I believe that Maine has very, very strict controls, but this is Maine is an exception in this regard. Those controls are not the kinds of controls that you find elsewhere where salmon is being farmed.
I don't disagree with that, and I think maybe much of this debate could be minimized if most of the other salmon farming areas followed Maine's standards. I think it's interesting that British Columbia, after a year of review, in fact, has put out a list of about 80 recommendations that virtually duplicate Maine's careful site selection and careful monitoring.
Now, just one brief question to conclude. Mike Weber, you wrote an article in which you questioned the value of raising predators generally. Again, 30 seconds, your comments on raising predators and whether it's a good idea?
Well, salmon farming depends to a large extent on the use of fish meal, and fish meal is produced generally from oily fish such as anchovies and sardines, about 5 pounds of sardines to produce a pound of fish meal. So basically we're catching one kind of fish, grinding it up, processing it, and feeding it to another kind of fish. If we're trying to feed the world, which I think is a goal that everyone believes in, I don't think that that's the highest or best use of fish, that is to be converting it into fish meal for salmon.
Joe, do you want to comment on switching the world to a sardine diet instead?
Well, hey, yes. I mean, the fish meal itself is only about 60% of the volume of fish feed, and the waste that's lost in creating the fish meal is primarily just the byproducts. It's the skeletons and things like that. I mean, frankly, you don't want the bones in there because it increases the phosphates that are wasted essentially in the fish feed. So I really don't think that you really have that poor conversion factor. And the salmon themselves are very efficient at converting the feed they do receive into flesh. It's moving into the vicinity of 1 pound of feed produces 1 pound of harvestable weight. So I really don't think it's an inefficient way of using these industrial fish sources.
I want to thank you both. We've been talking with Mike Weber, who is former special assistant to the director of the National Marine Fisheries Service, and Joe McGonigal, who is executive director of the Maine Aquaculture Association. They've been locking horns over the question of salmon farming. You could hear the Environment Show anytime on your personal computer via the Internet. Go to our webpage. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's enn.com/envshow. You can also use the page to tell us what you think. Otherwise, just call us up. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN.
This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The developing world doesn't just need money for development. It also needs access to resources and expertise. Since 1980, this has been the aim of the International Service for National Agricultural Research, or ISNR. ISNR helps developing countries gain self-sufficiency through agricultural research and improved resource management. Now, ISNR is using a new tool. It's the Internet. Janet Anderson of Radio Netherlands reports.
So you go through into the links. It gives you lots of different things to choose from, information systems, the U.S. National Agricultural Library, genetic engineering news. What's on the genetic engineering news?
There are homepages from other organizations.
Okay.
What is coming to this topic?
For someone who's never used the internet at all, it may all sound a bit confusing. But with the help of a computer, a modem, and Andrew Sokolowski from ISNR, I was looking at a whole set of pieces of information on scientific subjects specifically designed to give help to scientists from agricultural research institutes about policies and management. There are real case studies which you can follow with lots of questions. You can suggest your own solutions. There are links to other institutions with tons more information. And there's space for scientists in developing countries to ask questions directly and get expert answers. Kathleen Sheridan is in charge of publications for ISNR. She told me about the kinds of help they'll currently give agricultural institutes in developing countries and how the internet will help.
We can tell them how to use the resources they have in the most effective way, and we try to have them focus on priority areas. Often what we find is countries are trying to do too much with too few resources, so we give them advice on how to get better financing and better funding to make contact with the policymakers in the country, to try to establish priorities that are feasible considering their circumstances, to focus on what the population needs.
According to Kathleen Sheridan, the new internet project should also help ISNR target its work better, more according to the priorities of the institutions themselves. Rudolf Content is one of the scientists who've been working on the project. He told me why he thought it was needed now.
Everybody's setting priorities all the time. So institutions have to set priorities that fall within their resources. And this demand with increasing fund scarcity, scarcity in terms of human resources, which everybody is facing, big choices have to be made, especially when we talk about agricultural production. There are many environmental problems that have been grafted onto the previous agendas. Things are much more complicated. To increase yields, for instance, is much more complicated than it used to be when there was less population pressure, when land was less degraded, and so forth. So the agendas of these institutions is getting, and countries, are getting more complicated. Costs have gone up, and therefore the setting of priorities could become quite agonizing.
Is this a comment altogether to suggest that ISNR's work in the past hasn't been able to have that kind of discussion, and that really you've been sending the stuff out and have no idea whether anybody's made any use of it at all?
Well, this is not a question for ISNR, this is a question worldwide for almost every organization, including the big international organizations. It's a common problem that they have a mailing list, some of which is out of date. It's extremely difficult to keep mailing lists up to date. This is a worldwide problem. Apart from that, the material, once you've published it in book form, it is fixed and it is dated and out of date fairly quickly, particularly in this type of area that we work in. Furthermore, it's extremely costly if you send things out to a very large number of people and you haven't got the slightest idea how many people will use it. So by using the two approaches together, first of all, you do not expect anything that goes on the internet to be there forever. You keep changing it all the time. Your questions keep coming in. Your answers keep flowing back. And for the material that has a longer value, you can put that out in published form. And you are also sure that the people who do want to receive it are actually going to use it. It's not just a matter of cost and number of copies that's sent out, some of which reach no destination at all. It's also the fact that by having this interactive means, we have a much better idea of what's alive, what are the real issues. Mm-hmm. So I bet you that the pertinence of our publication is going to improve, the relevance is going to improve.
That was Janet Anderson of Radio Netherlands reporting. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. Paul Winter is a musician and a composer who uses the sounds of nature and natural settings to make his music unique. He presents a portrait of his special place, playing his soprano saxophone in a hidden canyon off the Grand Canyon. I had the opportunity to talk with him about his latest work. Paul, you've got a new album out. It's called Canyon Lullaby, and I'd like you to describe for me the place it was that you recorded it.
There's a very special side canyon of the Grand Canyon that I just discovered in the mid-80s after a number of river expeditions through the canyon that has the most sublime sound of any place that I've found yet on Earth. And it's a cul-de-sac canyon. It doesn't have a name as far as we know, properly a box canyon, but we spell it B-A-C-H apostrophe S, and we have to clamber up over small cliffs and use ropes, and we finally come to this amazing temple at the end of this side canyon that has an 800-foot wall that curves around kind of to embrace the space, so it feels like a great carved sanctuary, and it, of course, has been carved by water over millions of years.
And what does all this rock do to the quality and the sense and the emotion of the sound that you're able to create as you play?
Well, it does magic to it, and I'm not sure that I understand exactly what happens, but it was the first place that I had discovered in all of the years of trekking through the canyon and playing in different acoustic places that had the kind of sound that gives you, when you close your eyes and listen, the sort of majesty that one sees with your eyes when you look out from the edge of the South Rim at the vast panorama. It adds a richness. It gives you a sense of the vastness of the space and the ambient sounds that then come into whatever you're playing, from the birds to crickets to different creatures that are there, very much gives you the feeling that you're right there in the middle of the Grand Canyon.
The Canyon Lullaby includes sounds of wrens, house finches, frogs, and crickets, which were singing in the canyon when Winter was playing. In other compositions, Winter has taken the melodies of specific creatures and used them as a basis for a musical composition. He was inspired by the voices of whales.
It struck me that probably the most interesting thing I could do would be to see if I could find a pattern in their song, which I could play on my instrument, on soprano sax, or on the cello in our ensemble or some other instrument, so that a theme, even a short seed theme, upon which we would grow a piece, would actually be the composition, so to speak, of the creature, of the whale or the wolf or whoever it was, and that we could then symbolically say that we actually collaborated with that creature in making the piece and share publishing royalties with the organizations working to save those creatures in their habitat. And so the first one was from a whale piece, and we found a melody that I could play, and we harmonized it with human harmonies, and that has been a kind of pattern that we have used over the years in creating a number of pieces.
For our listeners who may not have heard you before, could you just hum, and this may not be possible, a theme that comes from one of these animal sounds that you've then used to augment a piece of music?
That's a great challenge. I haven't been asked to do that before. I'm sure people will be grateful that I play soprano sax rather than sing to these creatures. But the eight-note theme of the Humpback Whale song that Roger Payne had recorded, that's part of a much longer 20-some-minute piece that I use and that I play in the sax, has these notes, which I hope you'll be able to hear. Yeah, yeah.
Finally, I asked Winter what impact he wanted his Grand Canyon music to have on people that heard it. And he replied that he hoped to awaken the sense of gratitude and love that comes with feeling reconnected to the larger family of life on Earth. A feeling that comes to him in his special Bach Canyon off the Grand Canyon of the Colorado River. Paul Winter is a composer and musician, and his latest album is Canyon Lullaby, distributed by Earth Music Productions. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You can't raft down the Grand Canyon without Paul Winter and his sax. Get a copy of the show by calling 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 412. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, and producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Westcott. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.